Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This is the time set for the rehearing en banc in the case of Rafael Diaz-Rodriguez versus Merrick B. Garland. For our colleagues are appearing via video, and one of them.
I'm here.
Okay.
Let me just. Half of my face, so I don't know. Okay. I'll get my face back here.
Hold on. I just want to make sure everybody, we can hear everybody and everyone can hear us. Judge McEwen. Okay. You're muted, but I think you can hear us, so.
Yes, I can.
Okay. And Judge Gould?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. Judge Callahan?
Here.
Okay. And Judge Collins?
Yes, just fine.
Okay. And if counsel is ready to proceed, you may come forward.
It appears we've lost Judge Callahan.
I think she's on.
No, she's not on at all.
Can't see her, so I don't know if she's on or not.
Her name disappeared from my screen.
Okay. Oh, wait, hold on just one moment. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Difficulties. I think we've got her now. Judge Callahan, can you hear us?
I can hear you, and can you hear me?
Yes, and we can see you now, too. So.
Okay, I'll mute.
All right, thank you. Yes, for those on the video, if you're not speaking, if you could mute, I think that would be helpful. We're ready to proceed, counsel.
Great, thank you very much, and good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. David Zimmer on behalf of Petitioner Rafael Diaz-Rodriguez. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The statutory provision at issue in this case identifies three specific child-related offenses as grounds for removal: child abuse, child neglect, and child abandonment. That provision does not make a non-citizen removable if convicted of a crime of child endangerment. When this provision was enacted in 1996, child endangerment was not understood as a subset of abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Instead, it was understood as a separate, distinct type of offense. You can see this looking at contemporary dictionaries, which defines child endangerment as a separate term, different from abuse, neglect, and abandonment. And you can see it in the general consensus in state criminal law that, to the extent that child endangerment was considered a crime at all, it was a different type of offense, distinct from abuse, neglect, and abandonment. Unable to seriously dispute this, the government asks the court to treat the statute as a broad delegation to the board to make any child-related offense grounds for removal, so long as that decision was reasonable as a matter of policy.
Now, so may I just ask a question? I was on a similar case before, and there was a majority of the circuits who held that this phrase was ambiguous. Are you saying that we should decide that the phrase is not ambiguous at this point?
Yes, that is our argument, and I think that there aren't. I think it's important to recognize that the question isn't whether the statute has any ambiguity. The question is whether it's ambiguous as to this specific question. In other words, whether endangerment is a form of abuse, neglect, or abandonment, or whether it was its own type of offense. And not that many courts, in fact, I think the Second Circuit is really the only court, in our view, that has really held that it is ambiguous in that sense. And that decision came down before a number of Supreme Court cases that clarified how courts are supposed to approach this question at Chevron Step 1. So I think a lot of the arguments that you made in the previous case, we certainly agree with, and we think they're actually, under Supreme Court cases like Kaiser, are really appropriate under Step 1. We certainly also believe that if the court reaches the second prong of Chevron, that for many of the same reasons it is unreasonable, but we do think.
I'm not intending to convey that I'm stuck at the prior position, because there's been a number of recent Supreme Court authorities that have come down that have some impact there. But is this, does the statute become more ambiguous if you look at the phrase as a unitary concept, as the government wants us to do?
No, I don't think so. And let me explain why, because I think this is obviously very important. You know, I think that this unitary concept argument is really a red herring, in the sense that regardless of whether the board, you know, could come up with one set of elements that capture all three of these terms or wanted to approach them individually, what it can't do is sweep in conduct that was not abuse, neglect, or abandonment at the time that Congress enacted the statute. And the government points to really no case interpreting any statute that would allow this type of maneuver. So, you know, we think that the best way to think of this is really as three distinct terms, because they really were, if you look at the contemporary definitions and you look at state law, they were certainly overlapping but understood as distinct. But if, you know, if the board wanted to try to come up with one set of elements that captured the whole phrase, that's fine, as long as it doesn't sweep in conduct that wouldn't have fallen within the...
Is that really what we're supposed to do here? I mean, under Chevron, the question is whether, and I'm going to read this, the statutory provision shows that it's the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress. We've got four courts of appeal that say this is ambiguous. Doesn't that in and of itself suggest that there is ambiguity for purposes of the first step under Chevron?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And first of all, I disagree that there are four courts of appeals that have found this ambiguous in the relevant sense, and in the sense of ambiguous to whether this type of endangerment offense is abuse, neglect, or abandonment. I really think that the Second Circuit's decision in Flores, maybe Zarate Alvarez are the only cases that come close to addressing this. And none of those decisions apply the analysis the Supreme Court has made clear is necessary. I mean, if you look at Esquivel-Quintana, which I think is the most analogous Supreme Court case, the detailed analysis that the court took at Chevron's first step in rejecting the board's decision, nothing in any other court of appeals decision except for the panel's decision in this case comes close to resembling the type of inquiry that the Supreme Court has required.
And forgive me, but based on your analysis, other than what in this particular case the four circuits have done, what specifically did the Fifth, Third, 11th, and Second Circuit not do?
Sure.
That the Supreme Court says is required under Chevron Step 1, according to you.
Yeah, they didn't look at dictionary definitions of the key terms and compare them.
At what time period? Before?
At the time that...
After?
No, at the time that Congress enacted the statute, the contemporaneous dictionary... I mean, I think a lot of those decisions didn't look at dictionary definitions at all.
Is that a requirement?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, whether it's sort of dictionaries in particular, but it's definitely a requirement. If you read Esquivel-Quintana, you read Kaiser, it is absolutely a requirement that courts try to understand at Chevron's first step, make a real effort to understand what the statute meant. I mean,
we have two different, as I recall, it was two different time differences.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you just? I don't see Judge Callahan on the screen.
I'm here.
Oh, okay, can you, are you hearing everything, Judge Callahan?
Yeah, I'm hearing everything. I'm there.
Well, we'll keep tracking. Kwame, if you could just keep looking at that, let me know. Okay, thank you. I'm so sorry for that. I just wanted to make sure.
The question I had was, you got, if I recall correctly, two different dictionaries coming from different time periods used by different circuits. Which one is wrong?
Well, I'm not sure that that's correct. I mean, I think that what you're looking for is the dictionaries that would have informed you as to what Congress would have intended the term to mean. So I think the most relevant ones are the...
It's kind of like originalism.
Well, yeah, yes, that's exactly what the Supreme Court has held over and over again. If you look at the Wisconsin Central case, that's a recent decision from Justice Gorsuch, that, you look at the ordinary meaning of the statute at the time Congress enacted it. And, in fact,
can I ask, the panel opinion did come up with a dictionary definition for child neglect. Do you quibble with that definition? And then why doesn't child endangerment fit into that definition?
Are you talking about the Blacks?
Yeah, the Blacks, the right. Merriam-Webster's. It seems like there was a common meaning for child neglect. And I just don't see why endangerment doesn't fit into that.
Yeah, we don't disagree with the use of those definitions, but I think what those definitions convey is different than endangerment in a couple ways. First of all, it requires a violation of the legal duty. There has to be a legal duty that is neglected, and I think that legal duty doesn't, it only flows to people who have an obligation to care for the child, and that's why these neglect statutes, if you look at Merriam-Webster's, the example it gives in the context of children is failing to provide clothing and
food. Supervision.
Supervision.
It seems like that would fit into the endangerment statute here.
So I think that's certainly the closest, but let me explain why I don't think that that's enough, which is that I think that in the context of that, when you're talking about violation of a legal duty that is owed to the child, I think that what you're talking about with supervision is what Judge Watford described in the panel decision is a sustained failure to provide something. And
I don't know where that came from, though. It doesn't seem consistent.
What about, I mean, don't your children have a right not to be killed by a drug driver? Your client twice took a child in his car at the last time he was at 0.20. I mean, it's great bodily injury. We're not talking about, I know somebody at Mickey talked about it would separate families, but someone that drives drunk with their child in a car doesn't really fall into, that's, society wants to protect children from exactly that kind of abuse.
Well, sure, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to, so I guess several responses. First, obviously, you know, under the categorical approach we're talking about, you know, the specific facts here aren't determinative, and if you look at the California Public Defenders Association amicus brief, it gives numerous examples of the type of conduct that is brought, charges that are brought under the statute that do not involve this conduct. You know, but also...
And you have the misdemeanor, you've got me on, you know, I'm not sure that one... necessarily, but what is it, great bodily harm or death or great bodily harm? Anyone that's done traffic court knows that, you know, when you drive under the influence, I mean, if people have a conviction for DUI, the next time they get convicted of it, if they kill someone, they can be charged with murder. So it's pretty well known that it's dangerous, great bodily harm or death is likely.
Sure, but I would emphasize, if you look at the actual California case law, like People v. Hansen, which we discussed in the brief, the California courts have interpreted, and in judgment, I do want to get back to your question, but they have interpreted the word likely to encompass any harm that's reasonably foreseeable. I mean, that's straight out of People v. Hansen. And so I think the statute is actually far broader than it might read on first appearance. And again, I think that's where the California Public Defenders Association amicus brief is really important, and it explains the types of situations like leaving a child in a car while running into a store for an errand, or not using a car seat correctly, or falling asleep while children are in a person's care. So
why does the concept of child neglect include a pattern? Why wouldn't a single egregious instance of failure to exercise a duty of care or custody over a child be sufficient to qualify as child neglect?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I think that in general, the type of conduct that's generally captured by neglect, you know, that failing to provide food or clothing or medical care, you wouldn't encompass sort of one morning where you didn't give a child breakfast, or one morning where you didn't provide, you sort of forgot to send in a sweater on a chilly day. And in the same way, I think that one instance.
The court cases are often about surgery, like the lack of providing an emergency surgery to a child for religious reasons. That's often how these neglect cases are prosecuted. So that's a one-time event.
That's true, Your Honor. I think, I mean, medical care may be, where you have something where it is an incredibly acute event that might rise to the occasion. So I'm not disputing that there might be an instance like that. In the same way, there might be a particularly acute instance of putting a child in danger that maybe would fall under neglect. But what we're talking about here is something far more every day. We're talking about not fastening a child correctly in a car seat.
Is it the combination of the event plus the associated mens rea? So if you're not doing needed medical care, there's an intentionality behind that. But you're speaking about a negligent act as a one-time event, and whether that falls into the federal statute, correct?
That's exactly right, and I think that's where the mens rea does play into it. And we're really talking about what are often just mistakes, right? This isn't something where the parent is there's a sustained failure. It's something that's intentionally done by the parent. And I also think that, you know, for that reason, sort of the class of potential perpetrators is different for neglect and endangerment. If you look at the definition from Blacks, it talks about a parent or guardian. This statute is far broader than that, right? This covers anyone. If you look at People v. Perez, which we cite in our briefs, anyone who's in charge of a child for even brief periods of time, people with even less connection to children than babysitters.
So is your argument that neglect, sorry, negligence is not consistent with the ordinary meaning of child neglect? The mens rea of negligence is not consistent with that?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that in order to violate the sort of legal duty of care to a child, that you would require something more than negligence. Certainly,
origin of both those words, negligence and neglect, is the same.
Yeah, although if you look at the Black's definition of neglect, it actually makes very clear that neglect is talking about something different than negligence. It says that quite in the definition of, I think it's maybe the definition, yeah, in the definition of neglect itself, it talks about how there, neglect includes a violation of a legal duty that separates it from negligence. Although I agree with you that there is some similarity, but I certainly think when you're talking about anything that happens on one occasion that would rise to the level of neglect, I think it would have to be more than a mistake, sort of a one-off mistake that creates some risk.
This doesn't just cover mistakes, because, I mean, if you look at the pattern instruction for criminal negligence, it requires a gross departure from the way an ordinarily careful person would act in the same circumstances, and that it amounts to disregard for human life or indifference to the consequences, and a reasonable person would have known that acting that way would naturally and probably result in harm to others. And then on top of that, there's a requirement that they act under circumstances likely to produce great bodily harm or death. Now, when those are all together, why is that not neglect of a child when you have a duty because it's limited to care or custody?
Well, so first of all, I think that the duty, if you look at people v. Perez, I don't think we're talking just about people who have sort of what you would generally think of as a legal duty. This statute applies to people.
It's limited to people who have care or custody of a child. Anyone who has care or custody of a child has necessarily a duty with respect to that child. That's the premise of the statute.
Well, I don't think that that's how if you look at the definitions of neglect, it's talking about a legal duty and the concept more of something akin to parenthood or guardianship, whereas Perez says that this statute applies to people who have even less connection to children than babysitters. But I also do think that although, you know, it's just to get back to what I think is the bigger picture point that your question is getting at, that even though I think everything you read suggests that the statute requires a particularly serious mistake. There's no question about that. But it is still ultimately criminal negligence, not intentionality, not even recklessness. Recklessness is obviously an even higher standard, but you do have people who are charged under the statute and convicted based on, you know, effectively judgments about the whether their conduct was mistaken or not. And again, I'd urge the court to look at the Public Defenders Association amicus brief that this statute is charged and interpreted by the California courts incredibly broadly, far more broadly than it might appear when you just look at the language itself. And I don't think that this type of one-off incident rises to the level of neglect. And I'd also, you know, point out, Your Honor, that what we're talking, that the board's decision in this case was not anything specific to this California statute. The board was just applying its sort of sweeping rule that endangerment statutes writ large are removable offenses. And if you look at the first section of the American Immigration Lawyers Association amicus brief, it gives examples. I mean, if you look at Ibarra, right, this is a single mother of 7 U.S. citizen children who'd been here since she was 4. The children were left unharmed and unattended while the mother went to work, and she didn't even intend to leave the children unattended. It was effectively an accident. No one was hurt. And the board says, you know, fine, that's a removable offense. And, you know, that type of conduct, and you have similar conduct charged under the New York statute at issue, similar conduct charged under the Oregon statute. And so, yes, this is a particularly narrow endangerment provision, but it is still an endangerment provision. It still criminalizes negligent acts, one-off acts that create a risk of harm. And the board's reasoning here was not specific to this statute. I'm sorry. It's hard to...
I just hear you say that you don't think the conduct here arises as serious conduct? Did you say that?
No, I wasn't talking about the conduct here at all, actually, Judge Callahan. I'm in no way trying to suggest that the conduct here is not serious conduct. I do think this was, you know, a mistake that my client made. It was a very serious mistake. I'm not disputing that.
A mistake, too, right?
Sorry.
But let me ask you this. What's the minimum mens rea required for a conviction under California Penal Code 273AA? And how does that differ from the BIA's determination of the mens rea required by 8 U.S.C. Section 1227A2EI?
Well, the mens rea is criminal negligence, and the BIA held in Sorum that an endangerment statute that has a mens rea of criminal negligence is sufficient, and that's exactly the conclusion that we're challenging here. I mean, I do want to emphasize, just since we keep coming back to my client's conduct here, which, again, I'm not trying to excuse in any way, but I do want to emphasize that you know, my client went through a period where he was suffering from alcohol abuse and made these serious mistakes. But, you know, as an example, I mean, he is not my client, as he testified at 123 to 124, went into counseling, went into treatment, has not had a drink in more than a decade, has not had any interactions with law enforcement, save one speeding ticket in more than a decade. His children are enlisted in the U.S. military. I mean, so, you know, I think that this was I am not in any way excusing the conduct here in any way at all, but I think that
how should we interpret the Ninth Circuit's decision in Fringoso versus Holder when considering our position at step one? Is Section 1227A2E1 ambiguous?
So I don't think Fringoso really addresses that issue, because Fringoso ultimately concludes that the government lost, you know, that some actual harm was required under the board's decision in Velazquez-Herrera. So I don't think that Fregoso really speaks to the ambiguity of the provision one way or another. And you know, even if it did, you know, Fregoso was from well before all of the Supreme Court precedent that we cite in our brief. It certainly didn't do any kind of analysis.
I guess it was also a different endangerment statute, wasn't it?
It was also a different endangerment statute. That's right.
Right. And so, but it didn't encompass negligence as mens rea. And, of course, it was prior to Sorum, as you point out. So the question I have is, does Fregoso have any, given that we're in a bank court, does it have any continued vitality or teaching, or do we just ignore that?
Yeah, no, I think that Fregoso's only real relevance is for our retroactivity argument, just because which we're not, you know, I don't want to need to get into right now, but I think you're right, Judge McHugh, in that for purposes of this court's analysis, I don't think Fregoso really has much bearing.
Or Fregoso, I'm sorry, if I could just follow up on this, because I'm just trying to figure out, if just because the statute may be ambiguous in some circumstances, does that mean that it is ambiguous as to whether Congress intended to include negligent endangerment offenses?
No. I think that you can have a statute that's ambiguous in some ways, but can still unambiguously resolve a specific question. You know, we gave an example in our brief of a statute that covered, you know, the regulated vehicles. There may be ambiguous as to whether that covers bicycles, but it unambiguously excludes roller skates. And so we think you could say something like that here. We're not arguing that the phrase, that there is nothing uncertain about this phrase. The point is, what is certain about it is that it specifies abuse, neglect, and abandonment. And if you look at the dictionary definitions from 1996, endangerment.
So following up, so you have your dictionary definitions. What else in the textual analysis? What about the structure and purpose of the statute and its history? What else could you elucidate as far as in support of your argument that this should be resolved at step one?
Sure. I mean, there's obviously the state criminal laws, which we think really reinforce the dictionary definitions. And then, you know, the structural and sort of historical arguments are, I think, sort of tertiary, but I think they are important in the sense that when this was introduced, Senator Dole described the crimes that were being targeted as particularly vicious acts directed at children. And so to the extent the court, you know, views that as relevant, I think that really highlights that it makes sense that Congress is targeting particularly serious conduct. These are the most serious child-related offenses. And then I think that you have the fact that this, a conclusion that a crime was a conviction for a crime of child abuse, neglect, and abandonment has extremely serious immigration consequences that can make a single act And I think Judge Wofford did a good job of setting this out in his panel decision, where it doesn't really make sense that a single mistake involving children could ultimately harm the very children that Congress was trying to protect by separating the parents and making them, in many cases.
Are you aware of any other federal statutes that define child neglect, such as CAPTA?
They're civil statutes, but yes, I am aware of them.
Because I think there is a CAPTA 1988 version defined child abuse and neglect to include negligent treatment.
Right, but then negligent treatment was a defined term that I think is really similar to what I'm describing as neglect.
Negligent treatment includes a mens rea of negligence.
Well, yes, although I think that definition, I'd have to check, but I'm pretty sure that definition, let me confirm, but I think that the definition is not, I don't think that definition would encompass, I have to go back and look at it, but a one-off act, like a one-off negligent act that would create a risk of harm to a child. And I also think it's important that, that's a civil statute. That's a civil statute, and I think it really is important, and the Tenth Circuit emphasized this at some length, there's a real risk here in broadening, in treating the statute too broadly by looking to civil law. Civil law in this area is serving a completely different purpose than criminal law, because the whole point of the civil law is to intervene to help families and to help children, whereas criminal law is trying to figure out who to put in jail.
And in Escobedo-Quintana, the state also relied on federal and civil statutes, but the Supreme Court ignored those.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly correct. I'm not aware of any Supreme Court case that has ever interpreted a generic federal crime based on civil interpretations of analogous terms.
It's not even persuasive at
all. I don't think so, actually. I don't think it's persuasive. I mean, just because it's trying to do something completely different, it's not talking about criminal conduct.
Can we go even back to... Go ahead.
Even though it defines the term criminal abuse and neglect, because the definition in CAPTA at the time included an act or failure to act which presents an imminent risk of serious harm, so which seems to capture the statute.
First of all, I disagree that it captures this statute in the sense that, unlike some other statutes, there's actually no imminence requirement here.
Here it says likely to cause bodily injury, serious bodily injury or death.
Well, likely, again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the California courts, this is a California statute, and the California courts have interpreted the word likely to mean not more probable than not, but just to mean reasonably foreseeable. And I don't think that reasonably foreseeable harm is the same as imminent harm. I think that there is that phrase, crime of abuse and neglect, but it's not defining criminal conduct. It's talking about what conduct should get included in a background check. And I think in that context, as in other criminal contexts, it makes sense to the purpose of the law is not identifying people who should be put in jail. It is serving a civil purpose that's trying to help people, to provide more information to the public. And in that context, I don't think that those definitions are relevant.
You have suggested several times that because this is a one-off situation, that it's different. Why is that relevant here, whether it's one-off or some continuing pattern?
Well, I think it's relevant because, absent some maybe particularly egregious situation, the child neglect in particular really is not normally charged. Again, there might be situations of especially egregious intentional conduct that might rise to a neglect. But in the most part, you're looking at failure to provide food and clothing and sanitary living conditions, that you're looking at much more of a pattern of conduct. And I think that's where it sort of comes into it.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Yeah.
I know, Judge Koh, you had questions that you want to ask.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to ask for both Fragoso and the four circuit decisions that Judge Smith was referring to. Those courts found the statute ambiguous largely because there was no statutory definition and because other circuit courts had similarly found. Is there any basis based on the recent Supreme Court precedent to say that would be sufficient, that there's no statutory definition?
No. In fact, the Esquivel-Quintana makes clear that that's not sufficient to find a provision ambiguous. Esquivel-Quintana, the provision in Esquivel-Quintana was also undefined. It was added. It was added to the statute as part of IRIRA, just like this one. And yet the Supreme Court held that the Laffan definition just means you have to apply ordinary interpretive tools, and that's exactly what we're asking the court to do here.
If you want to reserve the rest of your
time. Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Erica Miles for the Attorney General. I'd like to quickly raise a couple rebuttal points and then dig in, but I want to make sure that I get out that ambiguity, step one of Chevron, necessarily means that if there are more than one reasonable ways to read the statute, it is ambiguous, and the court must proceed to step two.
So,
and in determining ambiguity.
Forgive me, your opposing counsel suggests, if I understood him correctly, that you could have an ambiguous statute, but as long as the portion, in this case, child endangerment that we're talking about is not ambiguous, it's not ambiguous for purposes of Chevron step one. What's your response to that?
My response is we're looking at the terms themselves. So the absence of the word endangerment in the statute is certainly a consideration, but it doesn't end there. And in 1996, the universe of these crimes against children, either individually as abuse, neglect, abandonment, or even collectively as, you know, viewed as ways of maltreating children, however you view them, none of them had specific elements or concrete concepts as to what type of conduct, the breadth of conduct, and the terminology that everyone was using that would somehow categorize this into the universe of maltreatment of children. And if you look at the states, which is what the board did here, the states very quickly point you to a lack of clarity. They use very different terminology, and I'd like to give you an example. This California statute has a companion, I would say a fellow state in Idaho, using the same language. California classifies this, it's abuse and endangerment. It's called willful injury and endangerment. It's under the chapter called abandonment and neglect in California statute. So it's categorized as a crime of abandonment and neglect. In Idaho, they call the same, they have the same misdemeanor and felony provisions. They're mirror images of each other. They call this injury to a child.
You agree that under current law, Chevron ambiguity is kind of a last step doctrine, that we only conclude that it's ambiguous at step one of Chevron if we've exhausted all other tools of statutory construction?
I would say the courts should be looking to the tools, traditional tools of statutory construction. I agree that the courts are needing to do this. However, in doing that, in reaching ambiguity, no one method is required. No one method is dominant. And it must come to a consensus. You know, the Supreme Court says must inexorably lead to ambiguity or lack thereof. And when you go through the tools of construction here, beginning with the statutory text, as you always do for statutory construction, we have three terms chosen by Congress: abuse, neglect, abandonment, as the crime of terms.
The panel's Judge Wofford's definition of child neglect.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Sure. The panel defined, had a common meaning for child neglect.
Yes.
Do you disagree with that common meaning?
I don't disagree with the common meaning. I would say...
Oh, that end the case?
Well, no. I disagree with the common meaning. I would add to that to say... I agree with the common meaning. I would add to that to say that I think in those if you're drawing from definitions, from dictionary definitions, a lot of times they're really referring to more of these civil concepts, the well-established concepts, and they themselves are using terminology that is still subject to interpretation. And
are you saying we don't go to the dictionary, even though it seems like that's what the Supreme Court is telling us to do?
Dictionaries are helpful, but to my point of the statutory terms, abuse, neglect, and abandonment, unlike when the Supreme Court is looking at these generic crimes like burglary, arson, extortion, which have a common ordinary understanding by and large in federal court and the model penal code as crimes in the states as having common elements, that is much more useful for looking to dictionaries, because these are well-established common law, long history crimes. These crimes about children here do not have a long history. And Shuler, the Supreme Court...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but under Esquivel-Quintana, doesn't this analysis ultimately reflect the level of specificity we have to get to? Because in Esquivel-Quintana, the issue was sexual abuse of a minor. And at a certain level of abstraction, that encompasses myriad different behaviors and state criminal codes and other things. But when the Supreme Court narrowed in on age of consent, it no longer became ambiguous. And so to Judge Smith's earlier question, we may grant you that there's a level of ambiguity at a broad level, but if you're narrowing in on those specific terms and whether endangerment is encompassed within them, why is that ambiguous at that point?
Because endangerment is subject to interpretation itself, and all of these terms are subject to interpretation. Let me start with Esquivel-Quintana, your question there, because as you recognize, the Supreme Court wasn't interpreting the statutory term, sexual abuse of a minor. All of the parties agreed that statutory rape offenses can qualify. So you've got a subset of sexual abuse of a minor that's in front of the Supreme Court, and there... The rub was, what is the age of consent? Which will qualify and which won't? So the interpretation and the statutory tools that were employed were about age of consent for the meaning of minor within this subset. Here, the parties are disagreeing whether or not endangerment would qualify, and here specifically negligent endangerment.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the parties were disagreeing as to Esquivel-Quintana as well. The government was proposing a different definition that was about legal age to enter into contracts. And so there's going to be disagreement, even reasonable disagreements, but that doesn't necessarily make the statutory phrases ambiguous.
Yes.
So I'm trying to find what... Why is this a different case than Esquivel-Quintana, which undertook that sort of textual analysis and came up with an answer?
Because the narrow question, this one element of what everyone agrees of statutory rape, this element of statutory rape, age of consent, the tools of statutory construction clearly led to an answer. And when you go through all of them, they all led to the same answer, and they didn't leave much ambiguity at each and every step along the way. Dictionaries, textual interpretations and situations in the INA.
Can I ask you, when I read your briefs, it seems like your step one argument under Chevron sort of boils down to there's no statutory definition, and look at what, you know, the 2nd, 5th, 11th, other circuits have done. Do you disagree with the criminal survey evidence that was, as an example, the survey evidence that most states did not define?
Because in Esquivel, if I can just follow up on this, because I think you told us that the Supreme Court, we look at what the Supreme Court did there, it seems
yes.
like that would be informative, and they consulted contemporary state criminal codes. So here, if you do that, an examination of the contemporary state criminal codes demonstrates that a crime of child abuse, neglect, and child abandonment excluded negligent endangerment. Because in 1996, which I think we're supposed to look at the time that this was enacted, only 14 states classified negligent child endangerment as a crime, and only 7 of those 14 states identified negligent child endangerment as either a crime of child abuse, neglect, or abandonment.
Taking the survey at face value for the breakdown in the numbers, as you just described, because I did find some that were misclassified, and I think, which goes to show how difficult state surveys are, every time there's a survey, let's assume it's correct.
Let's assume it's correct.
For now. The inverse that sometimes states like New Jersey, for example, and Alaska, for example, entitle it endangerment, but they're also rolling into that abuse. There aren't necessarily statutes entitled child abuse in some of these states. Sometimes they're called endangerment. D.C. calls it cruelty, and in D.C., it's both abandonment and endangerment types of offenses. When I talk about endangerment, it's high risk of harm.
Isn't that the very reason why, when we're applying the categorical approach, we look at what crimes are actually punished under that state statute? Because the states, as here, commonly use certain language but routinely punish a wider range of conduct under that very statute.
Yes, and I think the Supreme Court's decision in Shuler is a good example where the court was looking at serious drug offense, which is a federal offense, and that was defined by the conducts of manufacturing distribution. And the question there was, did the states need to specifically use the words manufacturing or use the words distribution, or was it more... were these terms more descriptors that were supposed to come within as long as the conduct was the same? And here we have the states were all over the place with their terminology, their lexicon, but many of them did criminalize the same conduct with different names. And like I said, there are the mirror statutes of with this California, Idaho, and there's also Arizona. They use different titles, injury to a child. California puts it under the umbrella of abandonment and neglect, and Arizona calls it abuse. So we have one not even using the term, two using different statutory terms, but then when you look at the statute itself, all of the conduct criminalized is exactly the same, and it includes both what we would call abusive conduct, actual harm, and endangerment conduct posing a likely risk of harm. And like I said, D.C., they call it cruelty, but that's covering both abuse and likelihood of harm offenses.
Why does it matter if you agree that there's a common meaning for the term child neglect? All we have to do is take the statute at issue, the California Penal Code here, and see if the elements match with the common meaning.
I agree that endangerment can certainly qualify as child neglect within the meaning. It doesn't, you don't need a pattern of conduct. It can certainly be a one-off.
You don't need to get to step two. You could win on step one, I think, is my point.
You could. I certainly encourage you to do so if you agree that child neglect as a concept, as a crime, encompasses that, because endangerment, abdication of a supervisory role or looking out for children is certainly neglecting their well-being and putting it at risk.
And what source of definition or what source would you draw from that to say that endangerment falls within neglect?
I would go to the dictionaries that we've been talking about, the dictionary terms, the civil definitions, which...
Which dictionary term are you referring to?
The Black's Law Dictionary for Neglected Child, the 1990 version for Neglected Child, and in addition, both the Merriam-Webster and Black's Law Dictionary for 1999, and then the ones moving forward as they got more inclusive and of the conduct we're talking about. This has been an evolving concept, as we all recognize. But to be fair, in 1996, when we're talking about Black's Law, that was really the 1990 version. And as I believe Judge Bybee pointed out in his majority opinion in the Martinez-Cedillo case, he pointed out astutely that when Brian Garner came in and he overhauled the definition. So that was from 1990 to 1999. The overhaul was drastic. So the 1999 version, as the board said in the 2004 version, seemed to be more aligned with all of the other authority it was considering, like the federal civil statutes and the state statutes.
Are you now arguing that there's no ambiguity as to the statutory term?
I am not.
In your brief, you argued it was ambiguous. So is your position now different?
The statutory phrase.
Yes.
The phrase itself.
Is it ambiguous or unambiguous?
It is ambiguous. As to the question about, is it ambiguous as to whether or not child endangerment or negligent endangerment falls in, if this court collectively agrees that child neglect encompasses endangerment, I would say then it's not ambiguous as to this precise question. But overall, the phrase is ambiguous. There's a wide swath of offenses out there.
Esquivel-Quintana, the court seemed to rely heavily on 18 U.S.C. 2243 and federal statutes, which had the age of consent at 16. Is there any equivalent federal statute in this context, defining any of the terms that we look to, one or the other.
There are not. And that is my point, you know, to go back to the why do civil statutes matter. To your point, Judge, there are no federal statutes. This is very different than the situation of well-understood crimes like burglary, even sexual abuse of a minor. Most of the time, there are also federal crimes to at least draw from. There are none here when you look at the term as a whole, when you look at the individual offenses. A lot of the, if you're looking at child abuse, that was more understood as a crime. Neglect and abandonment were still kind of more in crossover with civil statutes versus crimes. So the federal civil statutes were absolutely are guiding, because that's all Congress had in 1996 to look at. We don't even have model penal code definitions like most of these crimes that we're talking about when we're trying to get to a generic definition and ambiguity.
Can we look to CAPTA, which has a definition of child abuse and neglect?
Yes.
Even if it's civil?
Even if it's civil, because...
What's your best authority for that?
The best authority is that it's a toolbox of tools that you need to use for ambiguity. And depending on what you're...
Excuse me, counsel. Are you looking at the civil and still saying that it's ambiguous and then going to the second? Or are you saying... I'm confused.
I apologize for any confusion here. I think we're talking about a couple different questions here about ambiguity, whether we have clarity, period, for the statutory term and phrase, I will call it, and the terms within, and then the question here that's more narrowly presented about whether or not endangerment is encompassed. And it does, you know, as the board said, and as we've been discussing, the offense of child neglect would seem to clearly encompass, if you're talking about dictionary definitions, if you're talking about the federal civil statutes, they do encompass without ambiguity this offense. In the states, there is some ambiguity because most criminalize endangerment, for sure. We have at least 38 states that criminalize it.
Counsel, can I ask you this?
The more that we talk about it, the more ambiguous it gets to me. But that being said, in reviewing the BIA's interpretation of the statute, what weight, if any, should we give to the argument that the BIA's interpretation covers, quote, a single lapse in parental judgment, unquote, which might render a non-citizen parent removable? That's the parade of horribles that counsel for the appellant is presenting to us.
Certainly, it's a lapse of parental judgment is not, you know, a typical one is not one that the board would consider as meeting its definition. If we're talking about, unless it falls within like this statute, a high likelihood. It has to be likely or probable harm must result. That's where the board draws its line. And the California statute here is a good example where you have the misdemeanor offense where harm may be likely, and then you have this felony provision where it is likely or probable, and I take issue with counsel saying that it's not likely or probable.
Can I ask you this? I'm frankly confused. You had said to my colleague here that basically you could win on Chevron step one, which means the statute's not ambiguous. Yet you're maintaining, on the other hand, that the statute is ambiguous. Which is it? And if it is ambiguous, what is your very best argument? You've tried all kinds of things. But if you had to encapsulate your very best argument for why the statute is ambiguous, what is that argument?
The argument is that when you look at the traditional rules of interpretation together, none of them provide clarity and none of them converge on a clear answer of what the phrase means or what the terms alone mean themselves. There's no clear answer as to the types of conduct. There's no clear answer as to what Congress meant in 1996 or what even within the types of conduct, the breadth of conduct, how far, no clear answer about mens rea required for any of the types of conduct.
So
is there a sliding scale?
Having said that, do you now, if you will, repent your confession that this is unambiguous as to step one? Which is it?
We've always taken the position that it's unambiguous.
That it is unambiguous?
That you get it is ambiguous.
Okay.
Is your best argument that it's unambiguous? What's your best argument that it's unambiguous?
I don't have a best argument that it's unambiguous. My best argument was...
You were referring to federal civil statutes. Was that...
We have federal civil statutes that provide us with negligent treatment. But negligent treatment, I would say treatment itself does not fully give us a clear understanding of the full conduct that's encompassed. And that was my point. So if you view the definitions, the dictionary definitions for neglect, if you view the civil statute encompassing negligent treatment as clear and unambiguous, then endangerment would most certainly qualify. But my point is those terms themselves used to define negligence, used to define abuse in dictionaries, in the civil statutes, and even by the states themselves, which cross-reference their own civil statutes a lot of times, they're not bastions of clarity as to the meaning until you dig down and then get into case law interpreting what each and every state means as to
counsel.
Terms like injury. Go ahead.
How should we interpret Congress's decision to exclude endangerment crimes from the INA?
I would say that it should be interpreted as not an exclusion, an affirmative act, instead that use of the terms abuse, neglect, and abandonment have so much crossover, and the states bear that out, that by using those three terms, it should cover a wide swath of cases. And to be sure, we're not talking about the sexual nature offenses like molestation, like solicitation, enticement.
Isn't it important that Congress enumerated three specific crimes and left out negligent endangerment?
Well, I would take each... These are not specific crimes is my ultimate point here. Child abuse is not a well-understood or known crime. Child neglect, child abandonment, these three things are understood very differently. These words are used interchangeably. If you look at these state statutes, they use these more as concepts and as guideposts, like saying child abuse, for example, in the Arizona statute, which is very similar to this California statute. They call it child abuse, but it necessarily encompasses risk of harm, endangerment offenses. California here calls it injury or endangerment under the umbrella of offenses that are classified as abandonment and neglect. And
can I follow up with that?
Sure.
I sort of see
child abuse and abandonment as fairly different concepts. You know, if it's abandonment, you've left behind, you're leaving your parental duties behind. And child abuse takes on a different connotation of maltreatment of a child. And if you agree with me, and I'm curious what you think, doesn't that suggest that these are independent phrases? And to Judge Murguia's point, that endangerment, that the absence of the omission of that should carry some significance?
Well, it should carry significance because you're looking at the terms in the statute, but looking at what the states have done, there, as I said, there is overlap, and I understand that abandonment conceptually, as you view it, is different. It's not always different than endangerment. And endangerment can be abandonment. Endangerment can be neglect. And endangerment can be abuse. And in one state that I found, I believe it was Alaska, it's leaving your child behind under circumstances that cause a risk of harm. So it's not leaving your child forever. It's leaving your child in a situation where the risk of harm is high. So we have a state viewing abandonment, but that's the term that they use for this endangerment type of statute.
It can also be different. You're telling us how it can be the same, but it can also be different, right?
It can be, absolutely. And the intent here in 1996, let's just quickly go through legislative intent. Congress added a whole bunch of aggravated felonies to the ground of removal. Crimes against children never existed before 1996. They added this. They added the sexual abuse of a minor aggravated felony. And to talk about intent about whether or not somebody should be able to be eligible for relief, we were talking about, you know, this now bars cancellation of removal. That happened in 1996, too. It used to be suspension of removal.
Why Why shouldn't we follow the Tenth Circuit in Ibarra?
Actually, I'm asking you to follow the Tenth Circuit to the extent that they agree. There is no the traditional rules of statutory interpretation do not bring you to a clear answer. Four of them.
So now you're going to, it's ambiguous. So now you're back in ambiguous, and where it's at Chevron step two instead of Chevron step one, which you told my colleague that's where we could.
I fully retract that because it was a big if.
Okay, so then we're at Chevron step two. Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. That's where we want to be.
Okay. That's where you want to be.
That's where we want to be. We want to be at step two.
All right, and so then if you could just answer my question, because you said, well, if you follow the 10th Circuit in Ibarra up to a certain point, my question is not that. My question is, why do we not follow the Tenth Circuit in Ibarra?
The Tenth Circuit in Ibarra, in our view, was a very flawed decision that got them to the conclusion that we disagree with but can accept. They rolled back that they don't defer. They defer to the board's definition in every other way now after Zarate Alvarez. And by the way, we have five circuits that defer to the board, not just four. I just wanted to clarify that. It's also the 11th and the 10th does defer. You know, we know that now. So because of its flawed analysis, they should have remanded to the board. They found it was ambiguous. That's where under step two they should have remanded.
Can I ask you under step two
was our position?
Judge McEwen has
yes.
A question.
Yes.
I have a question. You've left me totally confused about your position because
I apologize.
You started down the path.
Did not do my job.
Of agreeing with Ibarra, and now you're telling us you want to that Ibarra was totally off base, and the statute is ambiguous and it's not ambiguous. So are you objecting to the result in Ibarra or the analysis or something else?
I'll just start from the beginning. We agree with Ibarra that it is ambiguous, that the phrase is ambiguous. We agree with that. We took issue with that at that juncture, them not remanding back to the board after determining it was ambiguous. And we take issue with their analysis, which they reached their conclusion only based on a state survey, and it was a flawed state survey. And so the way that they got to their answer, we take issue with that instead of remanding to the board. And so we take issue with the result, but we agree with the BARA that this is ambiguous under all the other rules of statutory interpretation.
So now you're landing. Your last and final answer is that the statute is ambiguous. Is that right?
The statutory phrase is ambiguous. Yes, we ask the court.
What about the Eighth Circuit in Pavey, or I think it's Pavey Garland? What's your position on that?
Which case is that you're referring to?
In Pavey Garland, which is I think a 2021 case.
Okay.
That's the Iowa statute.
I am not familiar with that.
All right.
Decision.
So let me just ask you, just get back to the final thing, is if we're talking about...
Was it pay? I think I was misunderstanding you. Are you referring to pay, P-E-H, pay?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying K. I apologize.
Pay.
Okay, so it is pay. So what's your answer to that?
The court didn't really reach it. They assumed ambiguity without deciding it, and they remanded the case back. So we agree with that. But it did provide a level of deference to, so I didn't count it in my five giving deference. But they did assume it in that case, and they just found that the statute wasn't qualifying.
Let me just say,
well, they declined to defer to the BIA, didn't they?
They do.
Okay, well, so if they declined to defer to the BIA, that would assume that...
No, they didn't decline to defer. They found that the board didn't apply its statute correctly. So they didn't do a deference analysis. They instead found, when you look at the state statute under the board's definition, that it didn't match. So it was more of an as-applied ruling as opposed to a deference determination.
Before you step back, let me just see if anybody has any other...
I have one last question, yes. If that's okay. Let's say you win on Chevron step one, that the statute is ambiguous. Then wouldn't the rule of lenity apply, and we'd still have to rule in favor of the petitioner? Or how do you account for the rule of lenity in that situation?
Our position, and I believe, you know, the way I read this court's precedent, is that the rule of lenity does not apply for immigration proceedings cases. This is an INA term, and while I understand that there's some question for dual application statutes, although this court still does apply Chevron deference, and it's in Valenzuela Gallardo, it's an obstruction of justice case where this court has...
The Supreme Court has held that rule of lenity applies in immigration cases.
It is held that it applies when you have a dual application statute, meaning like an aggravated felony, for example.
The only reason that we are applying Chevron deference in the first place is that this is a dual application statute.
No, this is not, by dual application, pardon me if I'm not
What I'm trying
being clear.
To say is that we're being asked to interpret a phrase that is in a statute that's within the INS's and DHS to administer or promulgate regulations. However, what they've put forth is a definition of a criminal offense. And so we are applying deference to the BIA's interpretation of a state crime. That's what we're being asked to do in this particular instance. So it's not actually dual in that traditional sense, but it is kind of asking for greater deference than I would think that the BIA would be entitled to in this situation.
The BIA would be would be entitled to Chevron deference because I'm referring to a dual application statute, it's those like the aggravated felony terms, those are used actually in the criminal context. So the concern that this court identified,
but negligence is, I mean, but neglect, abandonment, and abuse certainly is also used in the criminal context.
Not in for federal crimes context. So the BIA, the concern is that the BIA is giving meaning to the term crime of abuse, neglect, or abandonment, and that the board's meaning then will be supplanted or used in a federal criminal context, such as sentencing. Typically, we're talking about criminal reentry cases. So if the board defines an aggravated felony for purposes of removability, that definition would also apply for the crime of illegal reentry. Here, this phrase, the crime of child abuse, neglect, abandonment, only applies in the removability context, civil context. It does not have application in the criminal illegal reentry context. So the board's definition is cabined only to this definition applies for purposes of removability. For the crimes themselves, you know, while they have...
It's really my comment is addressed to the board's expertise to be defining these crimes in the first place, and I just might want you to comment on it. You know, there's an aspect of my dissent in Martinez-Zedillo where I catalog all the times the board has changed its definition, and in fact it's changed its definition again since Martinez-Zedillo. And isn't that just evidence that the board really doesn't have expertise in this area to be defining criminal acts, offenses?
I respectfully disagree that the board's been changing its position. I think it provided its original position in Velazquez-Herrera, but it wasn't complete. It left some questions unanswered. It explicitly said that it did. But it does have the expertise here because Congress put this term in this removal statute only. So what the board is doing here is just giving meaning to the states who have already decided to convict people of these offenses and trying to match up whether or not the state has convicted somebody of what Congress has said is a removable offense. And the board is being as even-handed as possible, where we have this broad lexicon and very difficult understanding of that meaning, but its definition is applied the same to every single state every time. It's you know, the Velazquez-Herrera primary definition, and then when we're talking about endangerment, it must be a likelihood of harm. That's where, you know, the board, if it's only possibility, the board draws a clear line. It applies the standard the same to every state. And so it's for the states to decide if their statute meets the board's definition, you know, through their own, the way that they define their offenses.
Thank you, Ms. Miles.
I apologize for going over. I just wanted to...
Well, I wanted the answers to the questions. Thank you, Ms. Miles. You may be seated.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I really just want to make one point, since I don't have a lot of time, which is that just, you know, the government asked the court to look to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary and the Black's 99. I think those were the dictionaries that you mentioned. And if you look at those dictionaries, what you'll see is that those dictionaries identify four categories of child-related offenses: abuse, neglect, abandonment, and endangerment. Those are all defined terms in those dictionaries right there. And I think that is really what this case ultimately comes down to. Congress listed three of those and left one of them out. And no matter how much the government may try to disguise it, that's just the way it was, that these defenses certainly overlap in certain ways. I'm not going to dispute that. And that there is some variation across states as to how these offenses were treated. I'm not going to dispute that either. But picking a few states that use different terminology doesn't take away from the fact that both of the key legal dictionaries that the government's asking this court to look at defines four child-related offenses, and three of those are listed in the statute, and one is not.
Counsel, what about counsel's argument that the specific definition of neglect encompasses endangerment-type offenses as well?
So, again, as I've sort of discussed before, I think it might encompass some endangerment-type offenses, like what Judge Bumate was getting at before, but I don't think it sweeps in the entire universe of endangerment offenses. Otherwise, why would there be a separate definition of endangerment in the dictionaries? You know, there was clearly a recognized need to have this separate category of offenses that encompass more broadly acts that, one-off acts that created a risk of harm to a child. That's what endangerment does that is different than neglect. And again, that's not to say that there's not overlap there. There's obviously overlap between neglect and abuse. There's overlap between, I mean, all of these phrases are overlapping in some ways. But the whole reason that endangerment is a separate defined term, that, that states create these endangerment defenses, is because it's capturing some conduct, generally lesser conduct, that doesn't fall within one of the other categories of child-related offenses. And you know, again, no matter how much the government would like to avoid it, at the end of the day, Congress identified, it didn't make all child-related offenses grounds for removal. It identified three of the four recognized categories of child-related offenses. And I think that at the end of the day, what we're asking the court to do is recognize that that decision has implications for what convictions count.
And so before your time's over, so are you saying decided at step one, Chevron step one, or Chevron step two?
Absolutely, step one. I mean, certainly, as we explained in the brief, we certainly think that we win under step two for the reasons in the brief. But if you just follow the reasoning from Esquivel-Quintana and apply it to this case, we think we win. And again, you know, the government likes to count the number of circuits that have found ambiguity, but read those cases. There's no reasoning in them at step one at all. And so, you know, we just don't think that those are really consistent with recent Supreme Court precedent.
Any other questions?
Yes. Question. Your argument on rule of lenity seems a little bit circular in that we're only supposed to apply it if the statute is ambiguous, but you also seem to be proposing that we use it to determine whether the statute is ambiguous. So if you could explain that, and then let's say the majority of this panel agrees that there is ambiguity here, how would the rule of lenity apply?
Right. So I think the Pacific Legal Foundation brief lays this out pretty well in the sense that the rule of lenity, the rule of immigration lenity is an interpretive tool, and standard tools of statutory interpretation apply at Chevron's first step. And this is what the Supreme Court did in St. Cyr. And so the way that I think it works is that in the context of Chevron, the way I would describe it is that, you know, if you have a real sort of 50-50 case, then I think you'd probably move on to step two. But if you apply all the other interpretive tools, and there's what the Supreme Court described in St. Cyr as lingering ambiguity, but, you know, that it's not 100% there, that's where lenity can kick in at the first step. And resolve that ambiguity.
If you always do it at step one, you never get to step two.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, and again, I think it sort of depends how you read St. Cyr, because this is what the Supreme Court did in St. Cyr, but I think what the Supreme Court meant by lingering ambiguity is that there's some sort of marginal ambiguity at which lenity might apply at step one, you know, whereas if it's just completely ambiguous, you're really throwing your hands up in the air, that might be a situation where you would move on to step two, I think. But I think St. Cyr makes clear that lenity does play some role, and in fact an important role, at step one, as that was one of the bases. And to be clear, St. Cyr was not a dual application statute. St. Cyr simply applied the rule of immigration lenity at Chevron's first step very explicitly, and that's a Supreme Court case. So I think we just asked the court to do exactly what the Supreme Court did there.
Thank you.
So no other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zimmer, Ms. Miles. Appreciate your oral argument presentations here today. The case of Rafael Diaz-Rodriguez versus Merrick G. Garland is submitted, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
All right. Session stands adjourned.